Up next, Linda Moulton Howe and her report on the H1N1 virus. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got Linda Moulton Howe with us. And this segment, Linda will be talking about the H1N1 virus. And listen, Linda, I'm going to pay close attention to this because, as you know, we don't believe that this is going to amount to much. So I'm very interested in your report. Go ahead.
Well, it is serious. Last Friday, October 23rd, President Barack Obama declared the H1N1 pandemic to be a U.S. national emergency. He said, quote, "The rates of illness continue to rise rapidly within many communities across the nation, and the potential exists for the pandemic to overburden health care resources in some localities," close quote. The goal now is to lift bureaucratic requirements to help hospitals and healthcare units deal more easily with the pandemic emergency. Doctors who have now seen a lot of H1N1 patients are calling it a very different virus. For example, Dr. Arnon Kumar in Winnipeg, Canada, told the National Post this week, quote, "This new H1N1 does attach to the deep lung tissue in people. When it does, it creates a very bad viral pneumonia, one of the worst we've ever seen. This is the sickest bunch of people I've seen as a group," close quote. Dr. Kumar says more than 80% of H1N1 deaths are caused by viral pneumonia, a similar characteristic of the H5N1 bird flu that has haunted the world before this new H1N1 influenza emerged last spring. CDC's Chief of Infectious Disease Pathology, Dr. Sharif Zaki, says, quote, "The new H1N1 is like the avian flu on steroids. It really is a new beast, so to speak," close quote. Other medical experts think in some healthy young patients, the person's immune response to the H1N1 virus is so strong and causes so much inflammation that the body kills itself trying to fight off this unusual virus. Unlike other seasonal flu over the years, this is the first time that virologists have ever seen the genetics of swine, bird, and human mixed together in one virus. It's so unique that no one has immunity to it except perhaps people over 65 who might have been exposed during World War II and the 1950s to a similar H1N1 virus that could have been a residue of the 1918 H1N1 flu pandemic that killed an estimated 100 million people around the world. One virus expert at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, is Dr. Paul Gleason, professor of molecular virology, microbiology, and pediatrics, and epidemiologist for the Influenza Research Center. He studied the way that 1918 H1N1 influenza first broke out in the spring and then came back in the fall with such global virulence. Dr. Gleason was also working in 1957 as an epidemic intelligence officer when the Asian AH2N2 pandemic hit with such worldwide force. Then came the 1968 Hong Kong flu pandemic, and his research data showed that the 1918 Asian and Hong Kong flu pandemics each showed up in the spring and summer before hitting much harder in the fall and winter. He is the one who coined the phrase herald waves of pandemic viruses and published the data in 1982. Dr. Gleason points out that this new H1N1 flu virus kept increasing around the world in the spring through the summer of 2009. And then by September, cases began doubling each week and have continued to increase through October, quite unlike more normal seasonal flu. Dr. Gleason also warns of another viral shoe about to drop, and that is the emergence of a more virulent strain of H3N2 in the southern hemisphere that is now making its way to the northern hemisphere. Its most vulnerable targets are people over 50. So between the two viruses, you're covering the gamut from infants to older people. Recently, I talked with Dr. Gleason about the additional threat of a stronger H3N2 flu virus and why the novel H1N1 is hitting the young and pregnant population so hard. Dr. Gleason begins with the link between this new H1N1 flu virus and the 1918 H1N1 Spanish flu pandemic. Here now is Dr. Gleason.
Okay. The 1918 pandemic virus was an H1N1 virus, but the hemagglutinin of the current H1N1 is much different than the 1918 H1N1.
This would explain why WHO and CDC and all of you in the medical community around the world have been especially nervous about this particular recombination that has H1N1 in it, because the last major pandemic was H1N1, the 1918 Spanish flu?
Yes, that's true, but that virus in humans has mutated a lot since 1918, and it appears that older people may have had experience with a virus similar to this in their youth, and so they retain that protection against infection with this virus. CDC has demonstrated this by testing sera taken from patients of different ages, and they find that essentially the older you are, the more likely you are to have pre-existing antibodies, and at the same time, they found that those people with pre-existing antibodies will get a boost with seasonal vaccine. In other words, seasonal vaccine will stimulate antibodies against this new pandemic virus in older people. And the younger you are, the less likely you are to have those pre-existing antibodies. And people born in the 80s, 90s, or the 2000s are not likely to have any pre-existing antibodies and are therefore very susceptible to this new virus. And since influenza virus is spread mainly among school children and college students, those are the people who are exposed first, and that's where we're seeing the serious morbidity now.
If this is a novel virus that has North American swine, has avian, and has human in the genetic mix of the virus, how could anyone have antibodies to something that is this strange?
Well, all influenza A viruses start originally from birds. So all A viruses are originally avian viruses, but then they occasionally infect mammals of different species, and eventually a virus emerges that will spread readily in humans. Now, the pig is generally considered the mixing vessel because pigs have receptors for both avian viruses and human viruses, and influenza viruses have a segmented genome. That is, their genetic material is divided into 8 different segments. And it's very easy then for these viruses to reassort. And they can sort into all combinations, you know. And some of the gene segments may come from pigs, some from birds, and some from human. And that's what's happened in this virus. But right now, let me say, it is a human virus because it is spreading very readily in human populations. So we'd have to call it a human virus. And this winter, we might see seasonal flu, particularly H3N2, produce an outbreak this winter. And we're concerned about that because they detected a new variant in the southern hemisphere this summer, and that might get up here this winter at the usual time for seasonal flu, which would be peaking in the middle of February. And H3N2 has been the major cause of mortality since it appeared in 1968. And it's produced epidemics essentially every other year since it occurred in 1968.
So we might have even a bigger spike in mortality in the H3N2 because of a new variant in its genome sequencing that has first surfaced in the southern hemisphere and could be up here this winter.
Yeah, that's possible because, as we said, the older population, which usually make up the majority of persons in the excess mortality, seem to be protected against the H1N1, but for some reason or other, they have not acquired protection against the H3N2 variants that have appeared since 1968. So most of the mortality, and this is largely in elderly people, that's occurred since 1968, has occurred in years when we have had H3N2 epidemics. So I think there's a good possibility that we'll have an H3N2 outbreak in midwinter of 2010. The H3N2 is a threat to the elderly population. The impact is very different depending on the age. And I think this H1N1 is going to have a very heavy impact on school-age children and college students. And there'll be some tragic deaths occurring in very young, healthy people. Each week since September 1st, the numbers have doubled. And we've seen a skyrocketing change in the number of people presenting with influenza-like illness to clinics and emergency rooms. So I think we can expect those numbers to increase. And it does not appear that we've reached the peak of activity for this wave yet. We're still going to see a lot of illness before this fall is out. The goal is to immunize everybody in the country. But obviously, if it's the younger people who are having all the infections and are dying of it, it would be best if it's targeted toward younger population now and pregnant women, because pregnant women have an excess mortality with this H1N1.
Why are pregnant women so vulnerable to the new virus?
Pregnant women are vulnerable not because they have any problem with their immunity, but as the pregnancy progresses, the diaphragm is pushed up so that their pulmonary reserve is compromised, and also they don't have the cardiopulmonary reserve that women in their age who are not pregnant have, and therefore they're more vulnerable. If they get pneumonia with influenza, then they're more likely to die. And the other thing to remember is that if a pregnant woman takes the vaccine, she makes antibodies, which are also passed to her new baby. It's no use to vaccinate babies before 6 months of age, so the only protection they can get against infection is the antibody that they get from the mother. So if the mother is vaccinated during pregnancy, she will not only protect herself, but she will provide protection for her baby that should last, hopefully, for the first 6 months, or at least for the first 4 or 5 months after birth. And that's a very vulnerable period for the baby, too.
And that the H1N1 novel virus could just sort of keep perking along until what?
Well, I think it'll produce a pretty sharp outbreak this fall. And then it may die out a little bit, and then it may either recur in the winter or it will come back next year.
In the fall of 2010.
Right.
And the question would be, will it have changed the agglutinate again so that it's more virulent or less?
It usually mutates in response to immunity, but whether or not it will change the virulence, that's really speculation.
By the middle of next year, what might be the projected deaths from the combination of these two viruses this year? What is normal and what might happen now?
Normal seasonal flu is 50,000 excess deaths. That's the average. And the direct medical cost plus indirect costs due to disruption of social factors is $87 billion a year just for seasonal flu. So the cost is very high for flu every year.
And how many more than 50,000 would you expect in deaths?
Well, I would expect the total to be, say, 80,000 excess deaths.
Not quite doubling, but getting up there.
Yeah, getting up there. But the age-specific mortality will be different because there'll be much higher mortality in younger people than we usually see.
And, George, American schools have been hit hard by the H1N1 virus. At least 351 schools were closed the third week of October, affecting nearly 130,000 students in 19 states, according to the U.S. Department of Education. Since the novel 2009 H1N1 virus spread from Mexico last spring, the World Health Organization reports that as of October 17th, worldwide, there have been nearly 500,000 laboratory-confirmed cases of this new flu virus and some 5,000 deaths. Those statistics are considered low because many countries stopped counting individual cases. Millions of people in the United States have been infected with the new virus. Nearly 22,000 have been hospitalized, and of those, there have been nearly 3,000 deaths now, especially young people and pregnant women. The mortality rate of the new H1N1 flu has been higher than normal seasonal flu, and the speed with which the virus has lethally attacked some people has surprised medical experts. This is why this is serious, George. It is not acting like a normal seasonal flu.
Well, we're going to sit back and watch. Do you get the flu vaccine at all during the year, Linda?
Oh, every year, every fall of my adult life. And I also, 2 weeks ago, I got a pneumonia vaccine. I couldn't urge that more strongly to a general population. The pneumonia vaccine, you only need one, usually. And because H1N1 is attacking the lung tissue in such a vicious way in the people that seem vulnerable and they don't understand what makes the difference, and the fact that H5N1, the avian flu, attacks the lungs deep and leaves this almost some, I've seen some photos, it looks like the lungs were turned into red hamburger, the virus attacks so badly, and those are people who have died. And what will H3N2 do? There is an H3N2 in Asia also right now, and the one coming up from the southern hemisphere caused a lot of problems in Australia, Argentina, and other countries in the past few months. If the influenza viruses that are out there are going to be attacking deeper and deeper into the lungs, it is more and more important to try to fend off pneumonia.
You know, this is really the only issue that you and I are on the opposite ends of the spectrum. And, you know, one of us will be right. I hope I am and not you, because this is a tragedy if these figures are as high as the doctors are predicting.
Well, this is, and it's happening around us. And in the state of New Mexico, there have been pregnant women and children who have, there's reports in the newspaper here all the time. There also have been some people who have been killed, again with pneumonia, from H1N1 in the 50s age group here in New Mexico. And I know that back in Philadelphia, that there are whole schools that have had so many people out with so seriously ill, and that this is a serious virus. And I am puzzled by why you think it's not serious.
Well, because I haven't seen really the data yet, and because, you know, we've interviewed so many other experts who are opposite this. But, you know, one of the wonders of this program is we balance it, you know, for every person that comes on this program and says, don't get a vaccine. We've got someone that you interview or even yourself who says, you know, I get it and I take it. And I want people to make up their own minds. I will not tell someone never to get a vaccine at all. It's not my business to tell them to get one or not to. I just tell people what I do or what I don't do.
Well, in terms of the stats, at earthfiles.com, at the end of my report update on 2009 H1N1, I have about a dozen different websites that have to do with Dr. Gleason's work, CDC, WHO, the Department of Education, Health and Human Services, and they are all trying to give the best and latest statistics. And I suggest that people look at some of these URLs at the end of Earth Files reports and all of these reports that I'm doing tonight, because go to the people who are expert in the field. And Dr. Gleason, George, is one of the most respected virologists there is, and he has lived through some of these major pandemics studying them, and he's very concerned about this novel H1N1.
Well, I tell you what we'll definitely do, Linda. When this season is over, let's see where we're at, and I want you to go back and interview him to see if he was right or to see if he was wrong, and we'll get it on the program. Well, this is the hour we call Conversations with Linda. We'll take your phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Linda Moulton Howe with us. And this, of course, is Conversations with Linda. Linda, don't you have Ryan Wood's Crash Retrieval Conference coming up soon?
Right. I leave next Thursday, and I will be doing a presentation on Saturday, November 7th. That's at the Tuscany Hotel in Vegas. And I will have John Burroughs from Bentwaters with me. He will be joining me in a part of my presentation live there. And We feel that Bettwaters is one of the most important cases, and he continues to have a key to this about what happened. And we continue to work with him in a lot of different ways, and I'm very happy that he's going to be able to join me for part of my program.
Super. Steve Bassett's going to be on with us sometime next week, so we'll talk a little bit more about that event. And I'll be in Chicago that Friday and Saturday at the National Radio Hall of Fame, but we'll be doing our show out of WLS Radio, Linda.
Okay.
So maybe Friday night you can call in with just a quick update on the conference.
All right. I can't remember exactly what everything is planned. We'd have to figure out that time when you're on versus what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I'll be on, let's see, it'll be midnight Central Time. So wherever you are. Of course, who knows where you'll be about that time.
Right? Well, we'd be in Vegas, so it would be 12 midnight. It'd be 10
10
p.m.
o'clock,
Pacific.
Your time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Hamilton, Ontario to get things going. Keith on the international line. Go ahead, Keith.
Yes, how are you doing?
Good.
Okay, good. I don't believe in this H1N1 swine flu. I believe last year was the bird flu. Before we had that, we had the mad cow, the foot and mouth, the SARS, the Beijing flu. You know, how many people, you know, right now are dying of foot and mouth, or how many people right now are dying of SARS?
You know? Well, it's there, Keith. The question is, how extensive is it? And that's where Linda and I differ, but that's where she's reporting. Go ahead, Linda.
But the question is, it's not an issue of belief. Viruses are viruses. And that is a part of the Earth life, that viruses attack mammals and birds and every, you know, living creatures. So I don't even understand the question. The H1N1 novel virus has the genome has been sequenced. We know that it is bird and swine and human, and we know that it has killed at least 3,000 people in the United States and 5,000 worldwide. And what no one knows is what will the pattern of this strange, unpredictable flu virus that is new, what is it going to do in November, December, January, February, and beyond? We live in a time where I think that you are very well aware that medical authorities have been worried now for at least a decade that pandemic viruses have surfaced and have taken out huge numbers of population on this planet in a cyclic basis for centuries. And we are due, whether it's going to be H1N1 as it continues evolving or not, or the new and more dangerous H3N2, or the dangerous, we already know it's dangerous, avian influenza, H5N1. These are all out there going in and out of humans, birds, swine, and so forth. And when they mix and they get into a dangerous category, and 1918 took out 100 million people, that's serious. And we don't know what H1N1 is going to do.
Next up, we go to Greenville, South Carolina. Alexander, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Alexander.
Hello, Linda.
Yes.
This is Al McNeil. I'm calling from Greenville, South Carolina. I met you in 1967 in New York City.
Wow.
At the Commodore Hotel.
What was I doing?
You were.
Now you're getting bold, Linda.
You were a speaker.
What was I? I was a speaker.
You were a speaker, and you were mingling with the audience.
Huh. Well, you have a good memory. I've done so many conferences.
And I met your father.
Chet Moulton.
Yes, I met him when he was in NICAP.
Well, no, he was never in NICAP. He was director of aeronautics for the state of Idaho.
Oh, well, actually, then I had met I met Princess Munau and Viv Demenis in 1967 in New York City.
Well, that's great. How about a question here, though, Al?
And the question is, there's a space station between Mars and Jupiter, which is controlled by the people that live on Mars.
Well, that's a speculative statement. That's certainly not scientific fact.
And another thing is, there is a base on the moon that is on the far side of the moon, and it has people from all different groups in different organizations. But another thing is...
Well, how do you know this, Alex?
That's what I
want to know.
I'm a contactee of Flying Saucers. I had my contact in 1952 in August 27th, 1952, in Oceanside, New York. And I now live in Greenville here in South Carolina.
And are you, and I assume you're still being contacted.
Yes, I am. I received a message from them. They have told me that the world governments better put their everything in perspective in order. And then the second thing they told me was the planet Earth is going to become telepathic overnight.
When?
They didn't say. They just said the whole planet Earth will become telepathic overnight. And they said it works on our planets. It'll work on the Earth.
Well, maybe so. All right, Alex. Well, thanks for all of that. Linda, you want to react to anything?
Well, I just want to say that over a long career as an investigative reporter and having interviewed, I think at this point, maybe 800 or 900 people in the human abduction syndrome over the last 20-some years, that what I began to see as a reporter is that there is a wide bell-shaped curve of information or lack of information in these interactions, and that lots of people feel like that they have been given some kind of truth, when in fact it seems to me that there is not a truth. There seems to be kind of this quantilisme of all of these different downloads and all of these different people around the planet, and that in and of itself makes me suspicious about the motive and the agenda, because if we were dealing with something that wanted us to completely understand straightforwardly what they were and what the relationship was with this solar system and this planet, assuming that we are dealing with some sort of other advanced intelligence or intelligences, it seems to me it could be a much more straightforward communication. And I am only trying to give a context that there's an awful lot of material out there that I don't think has anything to do with the truth, but is part of a pattern of download of very strange information person by person.
Okay, next up, let's go to Elsie in Atlanta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Elsie.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Linda.
Hello.
I just love you so much, and I always try to stay up and listen to Coast when you're on.
Thank you.
But I do have to ask you some questions regarding the flu vaccine.
Right.
I'm just not crazy about them at all, and I've been studying about them a lot. And I keep reading that the statistics on deaths are kind of screwed because the CDC stopped counting them. Could you comment on that?
Well, there has been a general decision by health people that the caseload has been so high and climbing that unless they have done a laboratory test to confirm, they haven't been counting everybody who has gotten sick in these particular statistics. So it means that the statistics that are being reported, 22,000 hospitalized and 3,000 deaths, mm-hmm. actually be quite a bit lower. But I want to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had the polio vaccine?
Yes.
And chicken pox?
Yes. Well, no. I did not have the chicken pox.
Well, I had
the chicken pox illness.
As kids have had all of these wonderful vaccines that medicine has developed and have helped keep us from having polio and from having smallpox and debilitating measles and on, and the influenza virus that has been a bane on humanity year after year for centuries, that we finally reached a point where modern medicine could try to come up with a vaccine like they have for polio and everything else, and that's the seasonal flu vaccine, which is not 100%, but it certainly helps in terms of fighting off some of these viruses. And the pneumonia vaccine is a wonderful vaccine. Therefore, I am really personally puzzled Where has this suspicion come from when the vaccine that is being made for H1N1 is the same process that has been used for 50 years to make seasonal flu vaccines, of which I've had dozens, and that the H1N1, it's the novelty of having avian, which is bird, and swine, and human mixed up in the genome sequencing that no one has ever seen before?
That was going to be my second question.
Okay.
About, did you hear the investigation that was going on with Baxter, in which they accidentally released that mixture or a very similar mixture to some country, and they tested it on ferrets, and they all died, and they said, whoops.
That was out. That's been out there for months.
And then they were the first company to be awarded the whatever, the go-ahead to start the vaccine.
See,
that's
to me,
questionable to me.
To me, we're on the air talking about things that none of us know the details. There's, I've seen these same things on the net, but I'm telling you, the material that gets spread on the web as being fact and is fiction or worse is much more, it seems to me, anymore these days than the real true pressure of fact. And I'm happy to try to get into this complex issue for some future program, but instead of using up time to just talk in ignorance, because none of us have the details beyond the fact that the medical community that I interview and talk to all over the United States and Canada, usually, that these are people who have been devoting their lives to trying to help save human beings. And I've taken the vaccine and others have taken the vaccine and we're fine. So I am personally, I am more suspicious about who started this conspiratorial language, of which I haven't seen a shred of proof, if there's anything wrong with the H1N1 vaccine.
Well, I got to get you on with Sherry Tenpenny one day and let you two go at it, Linda.
But we need data. Words are useless.
She's got it. She's got the data. I mean, that's what I mean. She's investigated this far more than I have.
Well, I could give her data to somebody like Paul Gleason, because I'm a reporter. You need to go to people who have medical knowledge.
Oh, absolutely. You've got Dr. Mark Siegel, who's been on the show. He is totally opposed to all of this. And I just want to see what unfolds this year. And, you know, what I don't like is the forcing, the quarantining, the plans to do all this. It's just, there's just too much going on. Let's go to you, Joe, wherever you may be. First time caller. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, George and Linda.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to go along the same vein. There's too much things going on. And if Linda, if you'll look up in Bild in the German newspaper, they were actually giving a version of the flu vaccine without the adjuvants, without the live cancer or whatever they're using for preservatives or whatever.
No.
This was for the H1N1.
Yeah, but look.
And this was
are facts that I do know about this part. Canada, for example, we've got a kind of broad-based experiment comparison going on between how Canada is handling H1N1 and the United States.
This is with German. But what I was getting ready to say was, is they had two different types. The ones they were giving to the general public. And then they were given the ones without the adjutants to all the military and all the people that are going to be working in the government.
Do you know what the adjutant does?
It's supposed to make the body work better to make the immune processes strengthened.
It's an immune booster.
To strengthen immunity.
Yes, and
But the thimerosal is the one thing, and I get sick with thimerosal. In fact, I quit taking the vaccines a long time ago.
Okay,
and
now.
I've worked at NIH, so I kind of know a little bit about what's going on. But the other thing I wanted to get across.
Sir, just a moment. You're throwing a lot of things out. Thimerosal is considered in the medical community to be the safest. It does not It does not absorb. It does not create a residue.
I have a reaction to mercury.
It has a small mercury aspect. You're talking about methyl mercury, which has a residue that can hurt people. When they use thimerosal in the vaccines, it is almost immediately it disappears.
Well,
and this is so we're into another discussion.
Well,
where there are pieces of what I consider to be speculation and not fact.
We're going to get Sherry Tenpenny's already emailed us, so she's ready to go. So if you want to find some of the other doctors, you and I can kind of referee. let's do it. Let's do it. Let's go to Asheville, Tennessee. John, you're on the wild card line. Go ahead, John.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Linda. Linda, I also wanted to talk about the H1N1. It's amazing to me that we can have a gene cross between birds, pigs, and humans. And I'd like to ask you, do you believe there's any way that it can be naturally occurring outside of a laboratory? You said earlier.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You said earlier that it was a new vaccine, but yet we know for a fact that they've taken the 1918 flu, the Spanish flu, and intermingled it. I mean, that's pretty clear to me. This is the same vaccine that they dug up.
No, sir. No. 1918 was an A, that stands for avian, which is bird. H1N1 is an avian virus. That's where 1918 started. Swine comes into play because the swine genetically is very, very close and similar to Homo sapien in many ways. And that a swine can be a mixing vessel on a virus that comes from a bird and can transfer to humans and vice versa. There have been some turkeys that apparently have gotten H1N1 from apparently some people, and they think they've got a pig that got H1N1 also from some people. So between birds, animals, and humans, viruses have been going back and forth for a very long time. The idea that the AH1N1 of 1918, that's where AH1N1 came into play and killed a lot of people. This is a new AH1N1 in which the genome sequencing is very different.
We're going to be back with final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe. This is a tough one, Linda. We'll be back. Well, tomorrow night begins our Halloween weekend extravaganza with a Friday night show that should knock your socks off or at least scare them off. So make sure you're part of that Coast to Coast show. When we come right back, final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Linda Moulton Howe. Final phone calls. And let's go right back to him. We'll go to Bill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Hi, guys. I just had a comment there listening to the abduction story.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to somebody that had a very similar type of viewing of a blue light on the wall of his bedroom. He was in England. And after talking with this guy, he was a British person in Moscow working there. He ended up coming out with an abduction story. But I thought the parallels of what that gentleman described with the light and the flying saucer was rather similar to what this guy had to say.
Did he see a beam come out of an aerial craft onto a house?
No, he was in his house, and he saw this light on the wall, and that's what got his attention. And you could tell after talking, I had read this large book about UFO cases. I forget what it was published, and I knew a lot of these stories, and I kept probing him. And you could sense, like, over the course of the evening that he was, like, inwardly, you know, sort of really disturbed at this experience he had, but sounded similar to the description that gentleman had.
Well, lights flashing on a wall would be different than being out in a balcony and seeing a whole craft in the air put a purple light on a house. And one of the things about these flashes on walls, I've heard them so much in my animal mutilation investigations, and I will never forget being on a ranch in Colorado where they had had a series of mutilations over one particular year. And I was talking with one of the ranch hands who had been out in a like a motor home, with his job was to stay where the cattle were out far away from the ranch house during the summer. And he was talking to me about how he was waked up. He didn't know why, but there was a pulsing red light, meaning there was light in his trailer that was pulsing from outside through a window on the wall right opposite of where he was sleeping. And he said, I couldn't believe my own reaction. I laid there staring at this pulsing red light, scared to my core. My job was to get up and get out and save the cattle. And he said, Linda, I couldn't move, not because I was paralyzed physically. He said, I did not get out of that bed. I laid there watching that red light pulse on the wall. And he said, the next morning we had a mutilated animal. And he said, I will feel guilty for the rest of my life for not getting up. But he said, it's not like me to not get up. Why was I so afraid?
Next up, Lori, we've got you in British Columbia on the international line. Lori, go ahead.
Hi there. Linda, I wanted to ask you something. About 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
And because I live in a small town, the tests were sent down, my blood work and stuff, to Vancouver to confirm this, right? And when the test came back, I was told that I was one of the luckiest people in the world. 10% population of people that get the hepatitis C kill the disease. It like kills the disease. Like,
it doesn't kill the disease.
Like, I will always test positive for it.
Right.
But I don't have it anymore.
Oh, you mean it would be like something that went into remission and is no longer a problem in your body?
Or exactly. She's now immune to it or something.
Exactly. Anyways, my question is, if my body can do that, fight off a disease like that, I mean, wouldn't I be able to fight off that flu without getting a shot?
Every single different virus, every single different bacteria, every body has a different immune history depending upon what it's been exposed to. So there is no guarantee ever as viruses and bacteria change that any human at any time in their life is going to have a guaranteed immunity against evolving disease. It doesn't work that way. That's why viruses change the hemagglutinin. They change because, as Dr. Gleason was saying, viruses react to immunization. They no longer are being able to work in their host. The human body is the host to viruses when they are active. And therefore, the viruses then change in order to penetrate, whether it's lung tissue or whatever it is, more than they did in the last body. That is what is called the change in the genome structure of viruses. And sometimes they become less lethal, and sometimes they become more lethal. And that happens throughout the whole microscopic world that we are dealing with on this planet. We have good immune systems when we're healthy, but this time around in H1N1, it's the healthiest young immune systems that are killing themselves because the immunity, the reaction, is so violent in the body. The inflammation is so terrible that is what is killing the young and the pregnant.
Okay, great. Let's go to Reno, Nevada. Hey, Bo, west of the Rockies, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, George, Linda, how are you guys doing?
Great. Go ahead, Bo.
You got a question?
I know that the human mind is very powerful and capable of making us both sick and well. And I know one time, for example, I hate to admit this, but I woke up with a hangover and called into work acting like I was sick, right? And I'm a really bad liar, so I really had to get into character. And even after I got off the phone, I was kind of acting like I was sick. And I actually made myself really sick for like 3 days just from doing that. And so my question is, with all of this kind of fear and paranoia that's out there, that a lot of the media is putting out there, would that kind of preoccupation and paranoia actually help to serve proliferation of sickness, possibly?
Not, this doesn't, that's not relevant to H1N1. You ought to see and hear some of the interviews that they have been doing in New Mexico alone with some of the families who have been losing children and pregnant women and older people here. There have been several deaths and a lot of very severe hospitalization, and they have interviewed some of the families. And the families that have lost their children, and one was a case where the baby died with the sick mother, this is hard reality of living on Earth with viruses, bacteria, and being a creature who can be attacked by viruses and bacteria. This is not something in people's heads, and the media is simply reporting what the agencies, the government, the hospitals, the clinics, and everyone else is reporting. The reporters are not making this up. It started, recall, remember, in Mexico in February of almost a year ago, and the spread of the disease was so rapid, and Mexico had so many deaths, if you remember that, that that was what started the alarm bells going off at WHO and CDC. Could we be facing another global pandemic? And it was declared a pandemic, I think, by June. And it has been going around the world, easily transmissible human to human very rapidly. And now to hear doctors that have been dealing with hundreds and hundreds of patients saying, this is really a different virus. This is going down into lungs and killing people within 3 or 4 days.
But still, the numbers are relatively low, Linda, compared to the normal flu that people get every season.
No. The mortality on H1N1 so far has been above normal seasonal flu.
Well, 36,000 people die from the normal flu in the United States every
between
year.
That usually the seasonal fall seasonal flu starts really late October into November through February, right?
Right.
This has never stopped. H1N1 emerged in Mexico in February and has spread throughout the world, unrelenting, through spring, through summer. And this is where the doctors couldn't believe that cases were doubling, the number of cases were doubling every single week in September. That's not happened with seasonal flu before. And now we're at the end of October, and there is not really any end in sight right now for when is H1N1 going to peak? Is it going to keep doubling? And that means exponentially doubling between October, November, December, January, February. Will it have a respite while H3N2 gets here, and then will H1N1 kick back up in February? Nobody knows for sure, but no, this has not been like a normal seasonal flu, and the mortality has been higher than normal seasonal flu. We're not to February yet. It's February is usually looked at as the close of the flu season, and when Dr. Gleason said he expects 80,000 deaths in the United States this year, he means by February. And if that were the case, it would be up to nearly doubling the normal 35,000 to 50,000 flu.
Well, here's a report from the CDC that just came out just a few hours ago. They say that since this was started to get reported in April, that we have had 1.8 million to 5.7 million cases of the H1N1 flu. This is CDC statistics. That's pretty wide-ranging, 1.8 million to 5.7.
Well, remember, those are lab-confirmed. The number could be 20.
No, they're estimated. They're what they're doing is they're using a multiplier, they say, because they don't know, but they are estimating. They're estimating that 1,200 people may have died from the H1N1 flu since it began in April. If we're going to get 80,000 over the next couple months, that's going to be explosive. I don't see that happening.
Well, you're not including H3N2.
Well, as of right now, H3N2 isn't even a public notification yet.
Right. It isn't expected to get here before December.
So we'll see. I mean, I just, you know what? I'm very suspicious, as you are, of government. But in this case, you're not. How come?
I have a deep respect for doctors and the medical community. I've worked in medical programming since graduating from Stanford. I worked with the Stanford Medical Center doing a documentary for them. I have nothing but the deepest respect for doctors and virologists and microbiologists who I personally think are trying to help their fellow man not hurt us.
I think most are trying to help us. There's no doubt about that. But I also think that there is a core that gets funded by pharmaceutical companies and other special interest groups, and they're very suspect. And the problem is it's difficult for us as news people to weed through those people to see who's making money on it and who isn't. Let's go to Houston, Texas, first-time caller. Joe, we've got a few minutes to go. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, Linda, I really appreciate your broadcast in the past. You have every reason to be suspicious of government scientists. These are the ones that told us about we found out about the Tuskegee experiment. They stand sailors and soldiers on decks of boats and blow up nuclear bombs and expose them to it. They do the downwinder experiments.
You're talking about military, not Baylor College of Medicine in Houston.
Well, okay. The Great Influenza, have you read that book by John M. Barry?
No.
Okay, I recommend it. It's a great history on the original H1N1. And what's out now, according to a lot of folks, including Alex Jones, is a cooked formula of one part European fowl, one part Asian swine, and one part resurrected 1918 flu. And the flu doesn't actually know where it's going. It just naturally evolves over time in its own little program, and occasionally it hits a combination that's extremely viral and extremely deadly. And this one, they may have started off trying to make it go that direction, but it hasn't gone that way yet.
To me, this is chop suey information, bits and pieces from the Internet, and I'm sorry, the current AH1N1, the novel virus, the hemagglutinin, which is the genome sequencing, is not AH1N1-1918. If it were, we would be having skyrocketing deaths all over the world. We were fortunate that the hemagglutinin in the AH1N1 was just different enough that it is not that virulent. No, this is not a reconstitution in somebody's lab of AH1N1-1918. And the whole genetic sequencing, that when they study that, if they know where the various sources, that's how they know that it was avian and it was swine and humans. But the fact that this has happened as a trio, when in the past they've had avian, which would be an A virus, this in some ways has come from the whole evolution of viruses that get in and out of different creatures, and that viruses can keep evolving and changing the hemagglutinin enough that this is what has happened. But when you get a novel virus like this, that's what makes them so dangerous, that there is no immunity to them unless you come up with a vaccine.
Well, Linda, would you agree that governments are secretly making biologicals for whatever reason, but they're doing it in their government-run laboratories?
George, military, Pentagon, Department of Defense, have been doing all kinds of ghastly things for decades.
So what if military has released this biological on unsuspecting good medical practitioners who are seeing this happen?
I have not one shred of hard data of anything that you just said is true. What I do know is that Stanford Medical Center and Baylor College of Medicine and Harvard Medical School, that these are people who I personally hugely respect and do not think that they are on doing any conspiracy trying to infect us for money with influenza.
No, but they may be on the receiving end like us. They may have no idea what's going on.
Nature has been spitting out sometimes very lethal viruses for centuries.
I've got to tell you, for someone, though, and you know how much I respect you as a reporter, who believes that crop formations are coming from non-earthly systems, for someone who believes that there could be something
now, hold on. The only thing that I have ever reported is the work of biophysicist W.C. Levengood in Michigan, that a spinning plasma vortex that contains microwave and electronic energies has been working back from the crops and the soil out is responsible, but it doesn't say what the source is.
Well, I know, but you get very upset when you're told that they're made by man, and we're out of time. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.